This is Fresh Air. Can women be equal if they have to assume more than equal responsibility for raising their children? Mary Frances Berry thinks not. In her new book, The Politics of Parenthood, she goes back through history to see how today's assumptions about parenting compare to those of the past. Berry is a lawyer, a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She writes, "Despair compelled me to write this book. I asked, what kind of despair?"
The despair expressed by my students and by friends of mine who seemed to believe that women absolutely have to take care of children, and even if they have jobs and no matter what their other responsibilities are, and that this is not something that men necessarily have to do or regard as part of their lives, and a frustration that friends, students, people expressed about this being the case, but believing that it was preordained and that it had always been that way, and that it's very, very difficult to change it, even as some people are trying to change it today. And then I did this research on the history of childcare and women's rights and found out that in point of fact, that in the colonial period and the early part of the history of this country, that fathers played a much more important role in caring for children than they do today, and that that was generally understood to be the right thing to do, and men even enjoyed doing it, and that the children were no worse off or better off than having it be otherwise.
This was men who worked close to home on a farm or
whatever? In point of fact, before the Industrial Revolution in this country, and before the Industrial Revolution, almost everyone worked at home. It was the Industrial Revolution that took people out from home and greater urbanization. And in that kind of context, mothers worked at things that we send to, clothes we send to the dry cleaners today, or preparing food, all kinds of things around the house that had to be done, household industries. Fathers worked either in agricultural pursuits or even if they were professionals and were lawyers, for example. People worked at home. Children were there. If they were around, they could do it. And in point of fact, the religion, the religious reasons played a role too, because in the colonial period, the understanding in the Protestant religion of the Puritans in New England and other people in the colonies was that women were sinful creatures who could not be trusted to give guidance to themselves, let alone their husbands. And it was necessary for the man to have dominion over them and to treat them, to teach them the right way and to teach the children the right way, so that this fit in nicely with practical circumstances, gave the opportunity for men to do it, with the fact that religion said it's a great thing to do it, and that everyone understood that this worked just as well for children as otherwise.
I will say I know several men who really do take a very active part in parenting, and also that I know several women who were really surprised by their desire to stay home with their child after they give birth. You know, by that they found themselves wanting to stay home a lot longer,
right,
than they had thought they would.
Right, that does happen, and it is also the case that anyone who spends a lot of time around an infant, infants are very charming creatures, will bond with that infant. If fathers do it, they will bond. If people who are not even relatives, nannies and other people who and grandparents, will bond with an infant, it makes sense that a woman who has a baby and who has the infant there with her a great deal will find it engaging, will love it, will want to be around it. But the point is that if it's not possible to do so, or if the mother doesn't believe that she should do so or has something else to do, then in fact one shouldn't feel that the child will be neglected, the child won't be happy, the child will complain, because children, if they are taken care of by people who care for them and who love them, and it's quality care, will respond to that and will thrive.
What do you think policy and business need to do to catch up to the changes in the family?
What needs to happen is for more employers to provide child care at the work site. We need more family and medical leave or parental leave, but we need also paid leave, because unpaid leave is wonderful compared to no leave at all. But for people who can't afford it, even when they get health care paid for when they're off from work, they just can't forego the income, not being able to work. So we need that. We need standards for the child care services that are available, that are enforced. And even if we have all of those things, and I point this out in my book, even if you have all of those things available, an employer who gives child care, a good leave policy, and the rest of it, so long as women continue to think that they are principally responsible for the care of their offspring and worry that they ought to be there and feel torn about it and don't understand that this is a role that has to be shared with others and that there's nothing wrong with it and it won't hurt the children. We need all of those things, both on the policy side and on different, we need different perspectives from women concerning their lives.
My guest is Mary Frances Berry. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Frances Berry, author of The Politics of Parenthood. Can I ask you about your own family when you were growing up and
sure.
your upbringing? I've read that your mother had to put you and a brother in an orphanage when you were young. What happened?
My father left. He abandoned the family. My mother's story about it is that he couldn't find work and he was embarrassed because he was not able to be the breadwinner, and there were all kinds of problems. And he abandoned the family, and my mother did not have the resources to take care of us, and so she put us and other relatives were too poor to take up the slack. They tried, but they had their own problems. So she put us in this orphanage while she went to beauty school so that she could learn trade and be able to take care of us. And so we were there in the orphanage while she went to school, and she would visit us in the orphanage. And lots of terrible things happened to us. You know, it was a real sort of Charles Dickens kind of story, being exploited by the people who ran this particular orphanage. We didn't tell our mother because we didn't want to upset her, but it was one of the most chilling experiences in my life, and it shows what happens when you don't get good child care.
Well, it sounds like your orphanage was the equivalent of the daycare center for your mother, who couldn't have afforded any such thing,
right.
Even if there was one.
Yeah, it was the exploitative, the worst kind of exploitative daycare center, yeah.
So what happened to you in the orphanage? What? How were you mistreated?
Well, one of the men, the place was run by males, and one of the men who ran it we were very hungry all the time. They saved money by not buying food in quantities for us to eat. They would, for example, pour water into the milk and make all the kids line up. I remember this every morning. We would have to say, "Thank you, God, Jesus, for this food," while we drank this watered-down milk. And they would buy rotten chicken parts thrown out at the store and make stew with lots and lots of black pepper in it so you couldn't taste it. So we were hungry all the time. One of my earliest memories is my brother, who was a year older than I am, crying because he was hungry at night. And one of the men who ran the place used to buy himself food, steak, pork chops, and the like, and then he would sell the bones to the children. If your mother came on Sunday and gave you a nickel or something, he would offer to sell these bones to the poor kids who were there who didn't have anything else to eat. So I will never forget, it's one of the most poignant memories of my life, the crying, my brother is crying and always being hungry. And I used to say to people that I wished I had eaten more. Maybe I would have been tall. I always wanted to be very tall, and I have this dream that if I had a lot to eat, I would be really tall.
I don't mean to disappoint you, but I ate my share as a kid, and I'm real short.
I guess it doesn't work.
Didn't help me. How did your mother explain it to you when she put you in the orphanage? How old were you?
I don't remember the explanation, because I must have been about 3, I guessed. And my brother was a year older. He remembers better than I all the details of this. And he says that she, you know, and she tells me later, I remember from later, that she took us there because she didn't want to. It hurt her more than anything. But she took us there because she had no other alternative at that time. And so we had to stay there until she finished this course. And then she took us and got a place for us to live and worked as a cosmetologist, a beauty beautician in the back room of this house we lived in. And she worked at that for a number of years.
So how old were you when she took you out of the orphanage?
Oh, I must have been, 4.5, maybe 5, perhaps.
Were you angry with her?
No. I don't have I have this stoicism about things. And I don't remember ever being angry about it. I remember mostly being sad about it most of my life as a child. Being sad because I basically missed a childhood. I didn't have much of a childhood, even after that. We were very poor, and it was not a very pleasant time. So I missed the childhood.
Now, how did you start to get serious about education?
Well, my mother, who graduated from the eighth grade and then had the cosmetology school, had more education than anybody else in her family. She was the youngest of 12 children, and the rest of them didn't go to beyond the fourth, fifth grade. And she didn't go to high school because there was no high school for African-Americans in the town where she lived. But she always told us, you know, you're going to school, and I liked going to school, and that you should go as far as you can. And even her brothers and sisters sent their children to school. Almost everybody among my cousins went to college, even though none of our parents did. And I don't know where they got the idea from, but it certainly was a great one, and I'm glad they did it.
You went to Howard University.
Right.
Now, growing up in a really poor neighborhood, what was your schooling like in grade school?
Grade school, my brother and I walked. First of all, we went to a school which was in our neighborhood, which had one room and a teacher who taught all the grades through the sixth grade, and who cooked a very wonderful smelling pot of beans on the stove, which was one of those heaters that you put coal in the room while we were being taught our lessons in the morning, so that you could have it for lunch. And you'd sit there smelling the bean soup cooking while she taught us. She taught all the grades in that room. Then after that, my mother decided that we should go to a better school, which was some miles away. It took us about an hour and a half, almost 2 hours, to walk to this other school, which was inside the city. And so my brother and I and my cousin would walk to this school every morning. It was quite an expedition. But my mother explained to us that we should be willing to do this because when she was little and lived out in the country, her father took her down to the creek every morning and brought their horse and put her on the horse, and the horse took her across, and then she had to walk for miles and miles, and then they'd come back and get her at the end of the day, and the horse would bring her across to the other side, so that we shouldn't complain about having to walk all the way to the school. People talk about school busing. There was no bus to take us to this school, and we went there. And then we went to junior high school and high school in Nashville and had some wonderful teachers. I was privileged to have wonderful teachers. I had some that were not that good. You hear some African Americans talk about in the old days of segregation, all the schools were good and all the teachers were wonderful. That's not true. But I was lucky enough in particular to have a wonderful teacher in high school whose name was Minerva Azalea Johnson. And she taught me and inspired me and told me that I was a really a smart person and that I could go to college. And she told me that I would be wonderful, I'd do well at it. And she gave me books to read and spent hours with me when we were not even in school, talking to me about what I'd read and so on. She regarded me as a diamond in the rough, as she put it. And so I'm very grateful to her.
I should mention here that you were the former president of, I forget which university is.
I was chancellor of the University of Colorado at Boulder, in Boulder, Colorado.
So you kind of came a long way from from a one-room schoolhouse to the head of a university.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
I want to get back to the politics of parenthood. Do you think that your personal experience in the orphanage when you were young and watching your mother struggle to eke out a living and take care of the kids influenced your decision to research the subject and to become something of an activist in it?
Well, I think the experience clearly influenced me to become an activist in causes, to become a cause person in terms of the rights of all people. And so writing the book came directly from that interest. And I suppose at a subliminal level, being aware of my mother's struggle to balance jobs and children and being aware of what that meant and the historic struggle of African-American women to do this influenced some of the things that I wrote in the book and made me aware of how this has been a festering problem for a long time and not one of 20th century origin.
Mary Frances Berry is the author of The Politics of Parenthood. This is Fresh Air.